The minute they smell a predator, they unite, which is why people are so obsessed with their enemies, because it unites the group.
Welcome to the Curious Advantage podcast, an exploration of the idea of curiosity and its increasing importance for thriving in the digital age from the authors of The Curious Advantage.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of the Curious Advantage podcast. This series is about how individuals and organizations use the power of curiosity to drive success in their lives and businesses, especially in the context of our new digital reality. It brings to life the latest understanding from neuroscience, anthropology, history, business, and behaviorism about curiosity, and it makes these useful for everyone. My name is Simon Brown. I'm one of the co-authors of the book, The Curious Advantage. And today I'm here with my co-authors, Paul Ashcroft.
Hello.
And Garrick Jones.
Hello.
And we're delighted to be joined by Loretta Bruning. Loretta is founder of the Inner Mammal Institute and Professor Emerita of Management at California State University, East Bay. She's the author of many personal development books, including Habits of a Happy Brain, Retrain Your Brain to Boost Your Serotonin, Dopamine, Oxytocin, and Endorphin Levels. Welcome to the Curious Advantage podcast, Loretta.
Hi, nice to be here.
It's great to have you with us. So to kick us off, Loretta, your curiosity about human motivation led you to a journey of exploration of the brain chemistry we share with earlier mammals. Since then, you've created resources that have helped thousands of people make peace with their inner mammal. I'm intrigued as to what this all means, so I'm curious to find out more about the journey. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about how you got here and what led you to start with looking at early mammals.
Sure. Well, like many people, I grew up around a lot of unhappiness. And every child tries to explain it. You know, what is everybody so upset about? Often the unhappiness was blamed on me. Like, that didn't seem like a good explanation to me. So I think at the deepest level, that's why I was always so motivated to try to figure out, like, what is everybody so upset about? And As life proceeds, most people settle on one certain explanation or another of what is the cause of painful emotions. But nothing was ever fully convincing and satisfying to me. So I was always, let's say, a big consumer, a heavy user of self-help books. And So I had a very deep grounding in psychology, but because it was not my primary profession, I wasn't stuck in one paradigm. Most people, like, let's say, the well-being professions, they are required to accept one paradigm, and that often excludes others. So I sampled a lot of different brands of psychology, and I would see one little mention of the animal brain here and another little mention of the animal brain there. What really got my attention was that this chemical was flowing when the animal had that behavior. And then somewhere else you'd read, that chemical was flowing when the animal had that behavior. It's like, wow, this is, to me, it's like, wow, that's the secret to everything. So then I started intentionally searching for that. And as I said, no one else had connected the dots. Academia is in silos, and the person who studies this aspect doesn't talk to the person who studies that aspect. So that's how I came to connect the dots and focus on that.
So it was the curiosity around following the links between the chemicals and the linkages to animals.
It was curiosity, but based on a drive to relieve pain, I would say, which is often a major motivator.
And connecting up the dots, And why did you name your institute the Inner Mammal Institute? It's an intriguing name.
Thank you. Well, two reasons. One is we literally have an inner mammal in the sense that the limbic system beneath our cortex is inherited from animals. Most people have heard of the amygdala, the hypothalamus, etc. And all animals have that. Other animals have little to no cortex, depending on what we're talking about. And so anytime we're doing something that an animal could do, we're using that limbic brain, and it does not process language. So it's not anything to do with your verbal inner voice. And yet, a lot of the time, we're doing things animals could do. So it's a huge driver in our lives. And yet, it's so widely overlooked because, like, talk therapy focuses on your conscious thoughts. And so that's one whole part of it. And the other whole part of it, when I was young, the inner child movement was a big deal. So I figured everyone could understand what that meant.
Lorena, it's so fascinating. What did your research show you about what you learned from mammals and what that means for humans? And you talk about our limbic system, but what did it mean for the neurochemicals that are governing us during the various changes we go through, unhappiness and so on?
Sure. Well, the huge bottom line of all of this is that the happy chemicals are not designed to be on all the time, which is the opposite of what we get from the disease model of mental health, where like people write to me and they say, oh, I have a dopamine shortage, or, you know, have low dopamine. Well, everybody has low dopamine, then you got to do something to make it go up. And nobody talks to us that way. Like, we're responsible for managing our own chemicals, and we're constantly managing them with the choices we make, which is so easy to see through animals. But the other thing is that happiness comes from these four, I call them the happy chemicals, dopamine, serotonin, oxytocin, and endorphin. Now, there are, you know, dozens or hundreds of chemicals that affect our behavior. And chemicals are the operating system of the mammalian brain and effectively the reptile brain. So a good feeling chemical motivates you to move forward, and a bad feeling chemical motivates you to pull back. And that's all. That's what's going on all the time. You're either deciding to go forward because you have a good feeling about something in front of you, or to pull back because you have a bad feeling about something in front of you. And we're just making that decision in more complicated ways. But of course, because of our conscious brain, we're like, well, what can I do to get more of that good feeling? And effectively, that is to meet a need. If a monkey is hungry, looks for food, finds the food, it meets a need. So that's the impulse to move forward. Monkey smells a predator, threat chemical, pulls back.
So I'm interested in the four chemicals, like what do they each do? But the other question that's is prompting to me is, like, you talked about decisions we make or things we can do that trigger the dopamine, or things we can do in the moment to change our state. Could you tell us a little bit more about some of the things we could do?
Sure. This is the subject of my introductory book, and so I'm going to condense it as short as possible. So dopamine is the feeling of excitement we have when we anticipate a reward. Now, each of those words is very loaded. So how do you know when to anticipate a reward? Like, one person anticipates a reward from going to a gambling casino, another person from shooting up heroin, you know, and another person from studying for medical school entrance examination, right? So all of our expectations are connections between neurons, and our neurons connect especially easily during the early years and while a chemical is flowing. So what that means is whatever triggered my dopamine when I was young built a neural pathway to tell me to expect a good feeling now when I have a similar situation. And it's easy to see that that's how animals wire themselves, that when I find food, neurons connect, and that makes it easier for me to find food in this context without intellectualizing it, but rather it's just electricity flowing down a pathway. I see that kind of tree, electricity flows to my dopamine, I feel good, I move toward it. So many people are frustrated with their choices, and I do believe in free will, so that's like another long discussion, but so much of our responses are from these old pathways. Now, people often do things to trigger their dopamine, and that's what we're meant to do, so that's not a problem. The problem is if you're triggering your dopamine in ways that hurt you in the long run but feel good in the short run, and the solution is always to build a different pathway. And what I always say is we have billions of extra neurons sitting around waiting for us to get excited about new things, but we don't do it because when a neuron's already connected in youth, that electricity flows so effortlessly that we flow there without consciously intending to. So the to-do, how to get more of the excitement of dopamine in a healthy way. So first, you have to choose a healthy alternative, and then you have to repeat it. And that's what it takes to build a new pathway. And that's the conundrum, because you don't feel like repeating it because it doesn't feel good yet. And how do you choose it when it doesn't sound good to you? So let's move on to oxytocin is often called the love hormone or the cuddle chemical. And in internet wisdom, we're told to get it from hugging. But everyone can see that if you hug someone you don't trust, that it doesn't feel good, and it certainly doesn't meet your need for social trust. So what we're really looking for is trust. But to go deeper, because internet wisdom is always glorifying and idealizing and moralizing these things, that it's a selfish impulse to get protection. Animals look for protection. If I smell a predator and I run toward the herd, that triggers my oxytocin because now I feel safe. I have social support, but it's not really benefiting the herd, you know? So we all want protection, but we learn that the way to get protection is to give protection. So there is that higher level of virtue of reciprocity and mutuality that helps us get that oxytocin stimulation. But to use a sort of a cliched example, that if you have thousands of people in a football stadium who are cheering together, that's an artificial way of sparking dopamine because you have that sense of being in a group with a common bond, but the important thing is a common enemy. That's what unites mammals. So when a bunch of baboons are feeding, they actually like to spread out because you don't want to eat food that has been peed on by someone else. Animals are very fussy about this, believe it or not.
Well, humans as well, Loretta, right?
Yeah, humans even anticipate, you know, if I go near you, your horns will poke me. So, but the minute they smell a predator, they unite, which is why people are so obsessed with their enemies, because it unites the group. So to answer the question, what can we do to spark our oxytocin? So a famous example is a person telling their life story to someone next to them on a plane. And you're never going to see that person again, and they're not really going to support you. But it's social trust is what we long for. And we decide who we can trust with neural pathways created by our past oxytocin. So the solution is always to understand my old pathways and then to give myself the freedom to do something new. So you know the cliche that a person has to keep being an alcoholic in order to keep having their friends. They think if I stop drinking, I won't have any friends. So it's always to build the awareness that you can spark these chemicals in new ways once you understand what the chemical is trying to do and what are your old circuits. So a simple example would be if you call a person and invite them for coffee and you might get 9 rejections, but you might get 1 acceptance, and then you have that coffee. And so it's taking those social risks that are really what it takes to build social bonds and focusing on the reward rather than the threat. And to move on to serotonin. So this is the complicated one that people don't necessarily like to hear. So animals are very competitive in their groups. And you could say that a monkey wants to be in a troop and it feels like its survival is threatened when it's not in a troop. That's the oxytocin part. But then it's at the bottom of the ladder of this troop. And if it's at the bottom of the ladder, the bottom of the social hierarchy of the group, it will not get mating opportunity. And then its genes will be wiped out. And natural selection built a brain that makes you equate any setback to your reproductive prospects as a survival threat. And although this was in like the 80s, 90s, 70s, like got huge amount of attention, it suddenly became taboo in the internet age to acknowledge this. And so when a person does an internet search, they come up with very little. And frankly, when the Intermammal Institute began, I conceived of it as a library because I purchased every single book that mentioned this. Actually, it was a British psychiatrist. I have all his books right here. So one big turning point for me was there's a monkey zoo in France, a couple of them, and they give a lecture on this in public to children, and not just for one monkey.
Yeah, I think it's not too far from where I live in Basel, Switzerland. Yeah.
Yes. And it's not just one monkey, but like then you go to the next monkey and they tell you how it works a little bit differently with the next monkey. At first, I thought it was my French because I heard her say that this monkey will never get sex if he stays at the bottom of the status hierarchy. So I went after and I asked her, you know, in French, do you mean he'll never have sex in his whole life? And she said, well, he'll have sex. He'll never be a father. And I thought, whoa, what could that possibly mean? My French was not good enough for that. So basically, I read all these textbooks in evolutionary psychology, and it's all there, but nobody talks about it now. So the point is, we all have an urge to raise our status in the social hierarchy. And it's not just males, because evolutionary psychology explains a jillion ways that it works for females. And it's so easy to see in other people. And in the modern world, when we have enough food and we're not investing all that energy to get the next banana the way our ancestors did, we put that energy into raising ourselves in the status hierarchy, just like monkeys do when they have extra energy. And nobody can admit that they're doing this, but your brain rewards you with serotonin when you do it. And when someone else gets the banana and gets the serotonin, then you feel one down, and that triggers your cortisol and makes it feel like a survival threat. And this is the subject of my new book, Status Games, Why We Play and How to Stop.
Is that why boys like Ferraris?
Of those who do. And that's because whatever made you the big monkey in your early years is what you're wired. So where I live, people hate the one with a big car, but that's their way. Now they feel like they're higher in status by hating the one with the big car.
And does that link through into the workplace as well? So that status hierarchy, would that translate through into a feeling of success in the workplace, leading to recognition, leading to promotion, leading to all that comes with that? So we would see serotonin triggering through positive interactions in the workplace, would we?
Yes, exactly. And conversely, cortisol triggered when you think someone else is getting the one-up position and making it feel like a survival threat, all out of proportion to this little minutia. The typical example is you go to a meeting, you express your opinion. If it's recognized, you feel great for the next few hours. And if someone else's opinion is recognized and not yours, you feel neurochemically awful for the next few hours. And many people are now learning to manage this by blaming the system. And I want to just be on the record that I'm not acknowledging. I'm not saying that. I'm not saying, well, it's the company's fault for not listening, because everybody wants to be the top monkey, and not everyone can be the top monkey in every minute.
All sorts of questions that elicits around the workplace, but maybe we cover endorphins and then we come back to some of those.
Yeah, we'll do that very quickly. So endorphin is the body's natural opioid. The word means endogenous morphine. And we always hear about it in the context of runner's high. But in fact, in nature, it's only released when you're in real physical pain. So if a gazelle is bitten by a predator and its flesh is still ripped open, it can still run, because endorphin masks pain with a euphoric feeling for 15 minutes, so that in the state of nature, you could take action to save yourself before you protect your injuries. And we are not designed to trigger pain to get the good feeling. So we're designed to chase the other chemicals, but not to chase endorphin. And yet we have this whole industry telling people that running is the way to be happy. And it only gives you euphoria if you run to the point of pain. And if you do that consistently, you're going to do permanent damage. I think my husband is out doing that as we speak. When people know that what they're really triggering is sort of like a one-up feeling about their health, and maybe many people are bonding at the gym, which is oxytocin. And dopamine is when you set performance goals and then you get excited about approaching them. But in the end, if you don't understand those other chemicals and the only way you know to get it is through running to the point of pain, it's not healthy. So to explain that, I use the example that if I step into a hot tub, I feel great for the first few minutes because it's actually painful, and that's endorphin. But after a few minutes, people may notice that they're back to who they are in their usual thought loop. And you could get more oxytocin by making the water hotter, but that would be crazy stupid. So I just want to be on the record of not advocating that. But laughing triggers a little bit of endorphin because it jiggles deep abdominal muscles that are rarely used. And you only get a little, but nothing is stopping you from laughing more.
Is that like a belly laugh?
Yes, exactly. And there's debate of whether it's a real laugh or a fake laugh. And I personally vote for a real laugh.
I just did some Googling while you were talking. Is it Paul Gilbert you were referring to, the evolutionary psychologist?
That's what I was going to say. But there's a Paul Gilbert at Harvard, but he's American. Was your the one you found, was he British or American?
I found two, to be honest. Exactly.
Oh, well, then that must be it.
Problem solved. Intrigued to come back to the serotonin, cortisol in the workplace piece. So it raises a set of questions, I guess, around if we're trying to create collaboration, we're trying to create an environment where people are working together, I guess probably creating that oxytocin piece of everyone going towards the same goal, not necessarily fighting a common enemy, but working together around what's trying to achieve. And yet then we have this base level going on within our brains that is triggering serotonin if I think I'm performing well, and giving me a negative cortisol threat drug if someone else does something that's doing well. How do we manage that, I guess, so that we're working together and collaborating in organizations rather than constantly reacting in a threat mode if someone else says something that's actually good?
Well, in all of my books, I say that this is the challenge that comes with the gift of life. So there's no easy solution. We're constantly working on it. And frankly, I think it's important for people to have enough free time that they can work it out outside of the workplace. So if I have ways to feel proud outside of work, then I don't have to have my whole sense of social importance hinging on every single workplace interaction, because I think that's where you get a lot of unwanted thought loops. You know how employees bond by then putting down another employee? It's so universal. It's such a fast, easy way to bond. And so being aware of that and looking for alternatives, like a simple example would be when I try to learn a new technology, I feel very threatened, cortisol, get frustrated. And if I bond with people around that, so that the technology is the common enemy rather than hating this other person down the hall, for example, by articulating some of this. And with the status thing, companies have gone so far in like eliminating all status so that the workplace just looks like a high school cafeteria with everyone thrown on top of each other. And I have a lot of writing called Why It's Always High School in Your Brain. If you Google Why It's Always High School in Your Brain, you'll come up with, it's on my website too. If you get rid of all of these status markers, people will still do this. They'll just obsess more over minutia. And one person has a life outside of work, and the other person doesn't have a life outside of work. So the people who don't have a life hate the person who has a life. So you can't really say, you know, so some company cultures are really bonding around hating the person who doesn't have a life. And it's important to be aware if that's the culture. And then one other thing, like in midlife, I moved from New York to California, where the acceptable bonding is around sports. So the non-work culture, like, that's okay to talk about is sports. And then everybody just obsesses over sports, but it's still the same kind of social hierarchy. So maybe it bears some awareness and humility about the fact that our animal brain is always doing this.
You're listening to the Curious Advantage podcast, inspired by the book The Curious Advantage, written by Paul Ashcroft, Simon Brown, and Garrick Jones. Subscribe to the podcast today.
It's a fascinating conversation, Loretta. I'm thoroughly enjoying it. And it seems one where the more we delve, the deeper you can go, right? In any direction that we choose. And I love these habits. And I know, you know, and we recommend your book, The Habits of a Happy Brain, if I guess people want to dive more into how to activate and boost these chemicals. Can we dive into one particular path at the moment around curiosity? Can we talk about what happens in the brain when we are curious? Have you looked into this?
Sure. So our brain evolved to forage. And what does foraging mean? On the one hand, you're never knowing where your next meal is coming from. So you're constantly scanning for potential rewards. So that's the job our brain evolved to do, to scan constantly for potential rewards. And there's two sides of this, because if you're curious and you go out and taste things, you could discover something fabulous, but you could also kill yourself in an instant. So our brain evolved to learn from this information gathering process. And you could say that the giant human cortex evolved to gather more detail, to accumulate more learning about this potential reward is good and that potential reward is bad, and mostly to learn instantaneously. You know the cliche that if one person dies from tasting that berry, that you're not going to go near that berry again. But then maybe a couple of generations later, then somebody will test the knowledge. So you could see that dynamic between, I want to test, I want to go beyond what's accepted knowledge. But there are real risks. And we know from history that like a lot of people who have succeeded at something failed many times. And a lot of the people ate the berry and died, and we don't hear about them. So that's why I'm careful not to glorify curiosity the way it often is, but to say that it has tremendous value. And so why the value is the good feeling of dopamine is when you anticipate a new reward. And the reason is that our brain habituates to the rewards we already have. So if you already have plenty of bananas, but then your need for protein is not met, so bananas no longer stimulate your dopamine because that need is met. So then when I look around for protein, that's like, oh, there's a possibility. There's a nut tree. There's a hunting opportunity. And so that's the good feeling. The excitement of dopamine is when you see a new way to meet a need. And that's why people obsess over new and improved and take for granted what they already have. And then even maybe take huge risks, because when you get a new resource, you can raise yourself in the social hierarchy.
I think that makes sense. And if I understand correctly, what you're saying, Loretta, is that we're programmed in some way to be curious because we're seeking out novelty and what's new. And it's that novelty that is giving us that sense of reward, that release of dopamine, and, you know, encourage us to learn. So my follow-on to that would be, how does then, and have you looked into how does being curious impact our memories and our ability to learn?
Sure.
Have you looked into the link between reward and curiosity and how well we remember?
Yeah. So here's a great story that the last time I was in London, I had two times ago, okay, I had this fabulous hot chocolate. And now I'm going to London again in a few weeks. And the minute I booked the trip, all I could think of is I have to get another one of those hot chocolates. Now, why would I think?
You got to tell us where you got it from.
Yeah, it's dark sugars on Brick Lane. And that's where my dopamine crawl is going. But the point is, I can make a perfectly good hot chocolate at home. So why do I care about that? Because dopamine is triggered by what's called excess rewards. There's a guy at Cambridge, Wolfgang Schultz, or Schutz. So he did the monkey work with that. So when work is, and that's another whole topic that has become taboo in political correctness. So when reward is above average, and that dopamine is like paving on your neural pathways that builds the connections that says, wow, this is great. And you could see why, because for our ancestors, the joy of finding, let's say I'm dying of thirst and I find water, there's two things going on, the joy of meeting a need and the connecting of neurons so I could find that water in the future. Even when it's 10 miles away, I could start seeing the little clues to that water that starts my dopamine that keeps trickling each time I get closer to that reward. And because in the modern world, I already have enough food and warmth and water, so a stupid hot chocolate triggers my dopamine. And then this, the connection between hot chocolate and London is not logical. And that's the important thing, is our wiring is not logical. It's just whatever triggered an extra above average, not average, is more than you anticipate. So whatever is the reward you anticipate, if it's more, you get a good feeling about it. If it's less, you get a bad feeling, which is also with social media. Like if I got 10 likes yesterday and I got 9 likes today, then it went down. I get cortisol rather than dopamine.
Yeah.
And then I'm having this bad feeling, even though I still got 9 likes.
It's a trap.
Yes, but it's a trap that a person chooses to engage in.
I'm intrigued by something you said in passing there, Loretta, as you were explaining. You mentioned a dopamine crawl. So it conjures up all manner of images as to what is a dopamine crawl. And can you share what is a dopamine crawl?
Sure. Well, when I travel, I like meet readers in different places. And so when I thought of that hot chocolate, I thought, wow, I'm going to meet readers at that hot chocolate place called Dark Sugars. And so it turns out the one that I went to no longer has seating. So I couldn't meet people there. So that's part of this idea of the dopamine crawl to get there and to stop at various places on the way that would stimulate dopamine. But I didn't explain why did this place trigger my dopamine, considering I make a perfectly good hot chocolate at home. So the reason is you walk in and it's sort of like it was dark with like these spotlights on these huge blocks of chocolate of different degrees of intensity. And you make your order and you which chocolate you want, and they personally scrape off the chocolate for you individually and put it into a cup. And this cup is filled with a mountain of chocolate shavings, and then they pour the milk over it. And I found that like so exciting. And that's what triggered my dopamine. It was really the novelty of it. And I think the bottom line is because we can only consume so many calories a day. And our impulse is as soon as I finish my hot chocolate, I want another one, but I know that's not good for me. So we make things fancier so that we get the more dopamine by making the one hot chocolate novel rather than having two hot chocolates.
You're firing dopamine all over the world in our listeners at the moment, as well as the hunger pangs for chocolate.
I have to tell you the end of this story. I was coming back from another trip and I had a layover in London. And then I went to the hot chocolate place to do reconnaissance for the dopamine crawl. And what I discovered is people were literally waiting online to video the guy shaving the chocolate. So this has caught on since the first time I went there.
So something that we ask many of our guests is how they would personally define curiosity. And there's obviously no right answer here. We'd love to know what you think curiosity is, Loretta, from your perspective.
I think for each person, it's whatever triggered my dopamine in the past wired me to expect rewards in that direction. And I think so many of us are shaped by that. And my hobby is reading biographies. And whenever you read a person who made some great discovery, you always, always find that in their childhood, they were exposed to that. And they were exposed to it in the context of pain. So the anticipation of reward is relief of pain. So the idea, like the classic example is, your mother gets cancer when you're young, so you associate medical research with reward. And then that person is like so focused on medical research. So in my case, I was very limited when I was young, restrained. I was not allowed to go out of the house much because my parents were very fearful. And then out of the blue, my father gets a trip to Europe as an incentive where he worked. And then he got a trip to Asia. So all of a sudden, my parents, who never left home, were traveling. So I got wired to associate travel with rewards. And also because when I was young, I couldn't really travel, but like studying about explorers and things like that. So then when I want a lift, I look to that. But other people, like my husband, he hates that. Like if I'm having to choose a hotel in London, like my husband sees that as work and I see it as fun. So everyone can look at their own circuits and understand the roots of it. And then if your circuits are leading you to heroin, then you got to rewire. But on some level, we also have to honor the circuits we have.
I was fascinated by what you said earlier about social media. And we were talking about, you know, the trap of the cortisol and the endorphins and more for less, and how some rewards are still rewards, but we perceive them to be less because of just our wiring and our expectation. Could you say a little bit more about what we can do to reframe or re-trigger or change that programming? I'm not saying we have a heroin addiction, but if we're wired in a way that's not being helpful.
So the first thing is, if a person can first honor their mammal brain is looking for social status. Everyone sees it in others, but doesn't like to see it in themselves. So when you get likes on social media, you get three things. If you get more likes than yesterday, that sort of dopamine, like I want to go there because I'm anticipating something better. But you also get serotonin of social importance, and you also get oxytocin of social belonging. So you're getting your needs met through that. And if you're angry at social media, instead you could say, I'm a mammal, I have these needs, I'm choosing how I meet them. I have a habit of meeting them through social media because it worked for me in the past, but I could build new habits to meet my needs in new ways.
Honor the situation you find yourself in and understand that there are alternatives. When you say oxytocin, it's like if I have a need for social and belonging, perhaps I could go out and meet it with some friends and make a change that way.
Yes, exactly. But also have to say that that has been a little oversimplified in the media. Like they show all these smiling people at a pub. And often when you go and meet friends, it's not so ecstatic, right? The way it's presented to us. I'll give you a simple example. Like I enjoy talking about my work like this. But when I meet friends, sort of the pressure is on me not to talk about my work and to listen to other people's problems. I don't find that very satisfying. Now, maybe other people are different from me, so I had to honor my own circuits, you know, and to break down these needs and understand them deeper and then create ways to meet them for myself.
I'd like to turn back to one thing you brought up around when we're talking about status in organizations and also how did you describe it? How your organization has become the high school? What was the phrase you used?
It's always high school in your brain. The reason for that is that our big neural pathways are myelinated, is the word. We have a lot of myelin in high school and then it droops. So whatever happened in high school builds big neural pathways And we flow there without consciously intending to, because myelinated neural pathways conduct electricity up to 100 times faster. So when you're upset with someone at work, what's really bothering you is something that happened in high school that you're projecting onto them.
Right. The other thing that people are in high school is curious often, right? Because we are just soaking up new knowledge. So if we take those two things together, how can leaders use some of the things that you've been learning about and you've been researching to foster curiosity, to tap into that wanting to learn in their organizations? What would be your advice?
Sure. Alas, I have to say that a lot of young people are not that interested in learning. And there's this culture of it's not cool to learn. People may have to do a little digging to find that love of learning and maybe have to focus on the obstacles in the way. So one obstacle is fear of failure. And another obstacle is social criticism. Like a simple example I mentioned, if you want to learn a new technology and maybe other people will think you're like showing off or putting yourself above them if you dive into that new technology that the boss wants to learn. And again, being conscious of that and maybe having a culture that can bring it out into the open and manage it. But the fear of when I try to learn a new technology and then I fail, so I could get very frustrated. So I put on a timer and I say, I'm going to work on this for 15 minutes and then have a hot chocolate. So I have positive anticipation because I know that if I keep working on it in 15-minute chunks, I will eventually get it. So that is problem solving. And then I know that I'm getting the reward anyway. So then I get the positive anticipation of the hot chocolate linked to the positive anticipation of the technology.
Right. And I've also learned that you're a fan of hot chocolate, right? This seems to be a recurring theme.
I'm using that as an example, but if I used hot chocolate all the time, then it would lose its reward value. So I have to change it up.
You have to keep mixing it up and inventing other things.
Well, I'll tell you, for people who are on a diet, I'll tell you, so 10 minutes of Netflix in the middle of the day has a very high reward value. And if you watch a movie in 10-minute chunks, you can't wait to get back to it. So you do that horrible, scary task on your desk that brings up all kinds of bad feelings to get your 10 minutes of Netflix.
That's a great tip for people. Netflix will wonder why their viewing figures are suddenly being skewed by everyone watching.
And maybe recutting their episodes into 10-minute episodes, right?
Exactly. But I'm thinking it works for learning as well. You know, if you've got a learning thing to do and maybe difficult, you got some research or you need to do some writing, you could break it up by going, I'm going to do this for 10 minutes and Loretta suggests, then you reward yourself with part of a movie or something.
Yeah, and there's the Pomodoro technique, which I think was Barbara Oakley came up with around breaking things into, I think, 25-minute chunks or so. It's the tomato timer, kitchen timer. So we've covered a huge amount, Loretta, from understanding, I guess, a little more of our animal brains and that chemicals play maybe a lot more of a role in how we feel than we give them credit. You took us through the four main ones around dopamine, how it triggers in anticipation of a reward, of oxytocin, so our cuddle chemical, the love hormone, how we need that trust there, though, for it to work. Then serotonin, so as a result of social importance and this urge that we have to sort of raise our status in the hierarchy, with all the repercussions if we end up at the bottom of that hierarchy and what we may or may not get as a result of that. And then the endorphin rush and that sort of runner's high and how in nature maybe that triggers when we get injured and we need to escape. And then the other side of things, the cortisol and how that may trigger in a negative way and how that may play also into the workplace. How interestingly, there's no easy solution to managing it, unfortunately, as much as we all like an easy solution. And some tricks that you gave us around maybe moving towards not necessarily person triggering some of these things, but maybe we look at, you know, actually how do we focus that common enemy outside of an individual person. We had the concept around why it's always high school in your brain and not fussing over the minutiae. And then what happens to our brain when we're curious as well? So how curiosity gives us that good feeling of dopamine, but it has to be in anticipation of new rewards, not actually something that maybe is met. And then the interesting trigger as well to social media there, and how those chemicals play a role in social media, that we may get the dopamine hit if we see increasing number of likes on our posts, but then when suddenly we see less likes, actually that cortisol triggers and we get the negative impact of that cortisol. We learned a lot about hot chocolate and where to go in London to get a great hot chocolate, and a new concept around a dopamine crawl as well. And then from a leader's perspective, how we can foster curiosity and how we can look at some of the barriers maybe that get in the way of people being curious. So that fear of failure and that social criticism as well. And how do we create cultures in our organizations where that social criticism maybe doesn't apply from a learning or a curious perspective, but we actually get reinforcing behaviors that foster that curiosity. And then finally, the guidance around breaking things down into 15-minute chunks or short chunks, rewarding ourselves with some hot chocolate or some Netflix. So a huge amount that we covered there. I'm intrigued if there was one thing that you wanted our listeners to take away from all of that. You know, what would be the one key message that you would sum that up in?
Well, often when I have a chance, I look for whatever I didn't talk enough about. So social comparison is a natural mammalian function, because when animals eat, they eat in order of their status hierarchy, which sounds very crude, but all of David Attenborough's earlier series, he talked about this before it became taboo. And so you are constantly making social comparisons. And if you don't acknowledge that you're doing it yourself, then you project it onto others and you think they're judging you. So, and then that gets in the way of curiosity when you're always thinking people are judging you. So it's so important to know that you're doing the social comparison yourself.
Fantastic one for us all to maybe move from our subconscious to our awareness and look for that.
So brilliant.
So thank you so much for joining us, Rusha. It's been great to have you on our podcast.
Sure. It was great to be here.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say, I'm interested in this problem about students, young people not being curious, not trying to learn. And I was a college professor for 25 years and I raised children of my own. And my husband is a physicist. So I'm aware that learning science, it takes a certain amount of work and memorizing. And when I raised my kids, it was the idea that learning should be fun all the time and you should never have to do anything unfun. And I feel that that was not healthy, and I didn't realize that until it was too late. So I'm interested in not glamorizing curiosity to the point where it substitutes this learning. If it's not fun, you don't have to do it. So yep. What other way can you talk about the unfun aspect that raises your knowledge to the level one famous Nobel laureate, I forgot who, said you have to almost know something in order to get it. So to discover something, you have to have a big base of knowledge first.
Such a great question, especially for those of us who've had children and raised children. It's always a question. But even for people with students, there's something that you said, which I think for me may hold the answer, and that's about the repetition. It's enough. You know, I'm a pianist, and the reason I'm a pianist today is because I was talented. I was playing the piano when I was 2, which is unusual. But the thing that my parents recognized was that they needed to put the child in front of the piano and encourage the child to be there. And just to play. I mean, I improvised and made things up until I got a teacher. But it was that there was a point, of course, when I was a teenager, I was like, oh, sod this, don't want to practice anymore. But I was encouraged to keep it up and then started getting rewards, because as I got older as a child, I realized playing the piano got me, you know, dates and got me friends.
Rewards.
Exactly. And that was the thing that then I was in a band and, you know, it all became that. And even today, it gives me those rewards. If they hadn't encouraged me to repeat it and keep it going in the tough times, I wouldn't have got over that hump, if you know what I mean. And so I would say encourage repetition I had a friend who I spoke to on the weekend about their child who wanted to give up this and give up that. And they started playing. They were in the choir and then they were playing football. And eventually, and she said to me, she did a deal with him and said, you do 2 terms of choir and see how you get on. That's all I'm asking you. And then we'll see. And he did the 2 terms of choir. And you know what? He enjoyed it. And then he gave it up and he went and he did soccer, and he did soccer very well. But it was that idea of persistence, because now he's come back to her and asked if he could join the choir again. So I think there's something about repetition.
Yeah. And I never did that because the advice was, oh, they'll find their passion. Just let them do whatever they want and they'll find their passion. There has to be a little bit of a work component, or you never get to the stage of being accomplished at anything.
And role models as well. There's a debate in the UK currently around particularly like girls not taking physics and not taking maths at a further level because it's seen as a hard subject to do. And what some of the folk in education here are saying is about shining a light on the role models in those sectors to back to not just girls, I'm sure, but girls and boys, that look where you can get to, look what you can aspire to achieve. Yes, it may be hard along the way, but look at what you can achieve by studying these topics. So, and that links back to curiosity, because we talk a lot about how leaders can encourage curiosity in a healthy way, simply by role modeling that to their people, them asking questions, them being curious, not just having the answer.
You know, learning can be fun, but learning doesn't need to be fun. And sometimes learning can be not fun at all. And in the past, as an industry, we've fallen into the happy sheet element, which there is, you know, some merit in certain elements of understanding pros and cons of a learning. But there's also a train of research that actually showed there was an inverse correlation between the scores in the happy sheets and the amount of learning that actually went on, that the more people enjoyed it, actually, the less they learned. And actually, it was some of the really tough learning interventions where people came out of that not necessarily feeling that they'd enjoyed it at all, but actually it created a stronger learning retention or whatever from or learning experience from.
Could you send me that?
I will have to try and dig that one out, certainly. But so yeah, my takeaway from that would be learning can be fun, but don't design learning with the goal that it is fun. Design learning for whatever outcomes you and change of behaviors and impact you need it to have, as opposed to the goal being fun. There's lots of other ways we can have fun if that's the motivation. So thank you, Loretta. With that, I think we will wrap up. So you've all been listening to a Curious Advantage podcast. We're curious to hear from you. If you think there was something useful or valuable from this conversation, then we encourage you to write a review for the podcast on your preferred channel saying why this was so and what you've learned from it. We always appreciate hearing our listeners' thoughts and having a curious conversation. So join today at #CuriousAdvantage. The Curious Advantage book is available on Amazon worldwide. Order your copy now to further explore the 7Cs model for being more curious. Subscribe today and keep exploring curiously. See you next time.
Thank you for listening to the Curious Advantage podcast. The Curious Advantage book is now available to purchase on Amazon. Stay tuned for the next episode and keep exploring curiously. This podcast is produced by Aliki Palinelli and John McGinty and edited by Jill Damatak-Futter.